All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William P. Green, Chief Judge, presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good morning. We're here today to hear the case of Hixon versus Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Will counsel representing Mr. Hixon please state his name for the record?
The appellant, Mr. Hixon, appears in person, or does not appear in person, but appears through his counsel, Kenneth Carpenter, also appearing as non-attorney practitioner, Glenn Monroe.
And for the government?
Gail Stroman, for the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Your Honor, and with me at counsel table is Thomas Sullivan.
Thank you very much. The court is in session, and we're here at the very lovely courtroom at the Washburn School of Law. It's our great pleasure to be here with you today. Before starting argument, or as part of the argument, Mr. Carpenter, you filed a motion in August to withdraw your original argument in this case.
That's correct.
Having made that motion, is it your position that you concede that the Sims case takes care of the question concerning Bernard?
That's correct.
All right. And that the board does have the jurisdiction to consider and adjudicate matters after reopening a case?
That would be correct, Your Honor, based upon the affirmance of Bernard by the Federal Circuit in the Sims case.
Either of my colleagues have questions concerning the motion? Very well. For the record, that motion will be granted, and we will proceed with oral argument, with the argument that you have presented in your supplemental brief.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Arthur Hixon. As a preliminary matter, as a preliminary matter, Your Honor, I'd like to bring to the court's attention a need for a correction and a citation that was made in the supplemental brief. Mr. Hixon's brief, supplemental brief, misidentified the dates and citation of this regulation and mistakenly referred to the date of first publication of that regulation, and in fact cited the date in which the final rule was published, and thereafter cited the amendment. The correct citation is August 6, 2001, in Volume 66 of the Federal Register at pages 40,942 to 40,944. That would be the date that was intended to be referred to in there. In his supplemental brief, we incorrectly referred to the date of the final rule and the later amendment. With that matter in hand, the argument before the court this morning is whether or not 38 CFR 20.903B applies and whether or not the board violated the requirements of that regulation. Section 20.903B is unique amongst VA regulations in that this regulation expressly requires that the board make a pre-adjudication determination of its intent to potentially deny a claim if the that is before it, if the board determines that it's going to rely upon law that was not relied upon by the VA in its decision. And under the provisions of that regulation, and the plain language of that regulation provides that the board will notify the appellant and his representative of such intent, and as a result of that notice, provide a copy of the summary of the law to be considered, and give a period of 60 days for the appellant and his representative to either submit new evidence or additional argument.
Now, that definitely focuses itself towards the board considering additional law.
That's correct. Well, yes, additional law, yes.
Does that include additional evidence?
This regulation does not address that. This court's decision in Bernard addresses additional evidence. I would submit to this court that the VA, in promulgating 20.903B, took this court's decision in Bernard and its own VA General Counsel opinion, which was cited with approval in Bernard, to one step higher, to deal not just with evidence, which was the evidence in Bernard, was the issue in Bernard and the issue before this court in Sutton, to deal with the question of dealing with matters of law. This regulation expressly refers to another section of VA regulation at 19.9, which identifies what is meant by the term law. And law is to include any case, any statute, or any regulation.
Which but again, not evidence.
But not evidence. Therefore, we are not talking about evidence, and this regulation, I submit, is fundamentally different from and one step above the requirements imposed by this court in Bernard.
Now, the board is the board has the authority to conduct de novo review when a case comes to it on appeal.
That's correct.
And that would include law and fact.
That would be correct. And this regulation imposes an express duty on the part of the board that if they are going to consider law that was not previously considered by the VA in its decision, that the board inform the veteran. This is unique amongst VA regulations, particularly with the qualification that exists in the regulation, that that notice is predicated upon a pre-adjudication determination that the board, before it decides the case, has concluded that there is certain law that it will rely on, and that law could result in a denial.
Now, in September 2006, you specifically requested that the matter be forwarded to the board for de novo review.
That's correct.
And you also submitted additional arguments.
I did.
And a different legal argument concerning presumption of service connection.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So those would be matters that the board, that you knew that the RO had not considered.
That would be correct.
And knowing that, then how do you, what prejudice do you see to your case that the board did not provide notice under 20.903?
Well, the prejudice that occurred to Mr. Hickson in this case was he was not given notice, he was not given the opportunity to be informed by the board that the
board...
That's
the error.
That's the error.
What makes it prejudicial?
Because the regulation expressly provides that part of that notice will inform him of what additional evidence the board intends to rely upon to his detriment, with the intention to deny the claim. That information was withheld, and more importantly, he was not given the specific opportunity to provide additional evidence and argument. In this case, Mr. Hickson was asking for the VA to remand for another examination. If the board had found that there was new and material evidence, then part of that additional evidence that would have been potentially submitted by Mr. Hickson would have been a private examination if the board was not intending to order a new examination, which clearly is part of the problem in this type of case because we are dealing with a dual issue when we're dealing with reopening. First, we're dealing with the threshold question of new and material evidence. And once that threshold is met, which was all that was at issue before the agency and all that was decided by the agency in the first instance, then you have to deal with the question, once reopened, do you meet the predicate requirements or criteria for an award of service connection, which is what he was seeking.
Mr. Carbon, you cited a number of statutes that you claim were not reconsidered by the regional office.
In their statement of the case, Your Honor.
Which statement of the case was that?
The original statement of the case in this matter, which originally denied the matter in, that was issued in November 18th of 1999. There were two supplemental statements of the case issued in 2004 and 2006. And in both of those, in one of the two of those, regulations were cited that were in fact relied upon by the board. And,
so were you cite 1101, 1110, 1112, and 1113 as not having been considered by the regional office? That was a misstatement.
I said that they were not considered in the first instance in the identification of the original statement of the case.
Would it matter if you just didn't consider it in the first one, if you considered it in a supplemental statement of the case? It still was considered by the regional office before the board, was it not?
It probably would not be a matter in terms of an error, but in terms of the statement that I made in the supplemental brief.
Which statutes do you view as not having been considered by the regional office that were considered by the board now?
Well, after examining, after receiving the government's response and examining the supplemental statement of the case, it's clear that the statutes and the regulations were referred to in the statement of the case. However, the important distinction here is that those statutes and those regulations were dealt with in the context only of reopening.
Which ones would be a concern to you or your client in the context of a new material? In other words, some of these, it's not going to matter because it was reopened. Your client was not prejudiced with regard to a reopening at the board because it was reopened. Your argument, as I understand it, is that he was prejudiced because after reopening it, they then considered for the first time whether or not he was entitled to service connection.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the prejudice occurs because the VA did not consider these statutes and these regulations on the merits of the claim. Their consideration in both SSOCs was limited to the question that was identified in each of those SSOCs, which was new and material evidence to reopen. It is clear that in all three of the adverse decisions made by the VA in this case at the administrative level, they never reached the merits because they said consistently that even after Mr. Hickson had submitted evidence, which the board later found to be new and material, that evidence was rejected as being new and material.
So your list of statutes really comes down to an argument that if the regional office has denied the reopening of a claim, which means the veteran got a limited duty to assist, and the board reopens that claim, at the time of reopening under this regulatory provision, and perhaps under some other cases and statutes also, but under this regulatory provision, it's your position that the board should have, at a minimum, come and announce that we have reopened it. And now do you want us to consider service connection or not?
In fairness to the government, Your Honor, the regulation does not indicate that they need to give notice that they intended to reopen. Do I think in the interest of fair play they should do that? Yes.
Then what notice should they have given?
Well, the notice that's required by 20.903B is notice of the intent to rely upon law that was not relied upon by the VA, to list that law and to expressly inform the veteran and his representative that the board intends to deny on the basis of that law.
That's the interesting question I have, not knowing how this works in practice. We look at it from the appellate bench. But in practice, I think what you're telling us under 20.903, that the board can go forward and adjudicate the case after it reopens the case, consider this law, and I guess consider this additional evidence, and if they are going to grant, it's okay.
Well, actually, Your Honor, I think that this regulation has, if you'll forgive the expression, opened a Pandora's box with what it has imposed in terms of demands on the Board of Veterans' Appeals. While it is logical to suggest what you just indicated, the fact is that if new evidence was submitted, then Mr. Hickson has the right to have that new evidence considered in the first instance by the VA and not by the board.
And that's under...
Expressly provided for under DAV versus Principi. That's correct, Your Honor, which negated the former 20.903B. And found that to be invalid and required under the holding by the Federal Circuit in DAV v. Principi that the veteran must be afforded the opportunity to have that new evidence submitted. So you're correct. It has the effect of requiring the board to give this notice, but then once they give the notice, if the veteran comes forward with new evidence and does not wish to waive consideration, then I believe the board would not be able to proceed under DAV v. Principi. But that's a separate issue, even though it is the issue raised by 20.903, than the question of new law that is being considered. And the new law, if it's just limited to new law, then I believe you're correct. Then that new law, after notice, after an opportunity to be heard on that new law, present that additional argument within the 60-day window that's provided by this regulation, then the board would have the jurisdiction and the opportunity to address the merits.
But Mr. Hixon is participating in this appellate process from 1999 until 2007. That's an awful long period, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And he's been through at least two board remands during the time in which I've represented him.
Okay, so those remands occurred after the reopening?
No. The reopening only occurred in the decision that's on review here. It was not until the decision that's on review here that the board rejected the VA's determination that new and material evidence had not been decided.
And the nature of the remands?
The first one was for consideration of evidence that had not been... Well, one was for evidence that had not been previously considered, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what the other basis was off the top of my head.
I'd like to take you back to 20.903B.
Yes.
Just to get a clarification. As I read it, if pursuant to the provision here, the board intends to consider law not already considered by the agency of original jurisdiction, and such consideration could result in denial. Not that they've made a determination.
No.
The board will notify the appellant of his or her representative, if any, of its intent to do so, and that such consideration in the first instance by the board could result in denial. So I go back to my question. Once they determine it's reopened, it sounds like your position is at that point, since now they consider regulations that, or aspects of regulations that have not been considered at the regional office, they should announce that we've reopened this, and now if we're going to go on to this next level, because you're bifurcating these statutes, let's face it, 1110 was cited by the regional office.
Yes.
But your point is they didn't consider basic entitlement because they never reopened.
No, because what was being dealt with before the agency was the jurisdictional question of whether or not the VA did or did not have to reopen. And they found consistently, as Judge Green observed, from 1999 to 2007, that they were not going to reopen.
I want to go back to part of your opening discussion. They also don't have to make a determination or let you know whether or not they're going to give you a medical exam. They just need to basically say, we agree it's reopening. Now, do you want us to proceed on this, no new facts, or do you want to send it back to the regional office for first review?
Correct. Because in that case, Your Honor, we would have had the opportunity to submit evidence in the form of obtaining our own examination. If they were silent, if they did not say that based upon the submission of the affidavits from the mother and the sister, a new exam was required because the 2004 examination didn't consider that lay evidence, then we would certainly be responsible then to go obtain our own examination and medical opinion and submit it. But we would be submitting it on a case that had been reopened, a case in which the VA's jurisdiction had been determined and the finality of the prior denial had been undone, at least until there was another final decision on that new issue of entitlement to service connection under the reopened claim.
I didn't see 3.159. It's hard to figure out where it goes. B4 cited.
In the SSOC? You're saying you're...
I didn't see it cited in your brief. This is the duty to assist. On a reopening of a claim, the duty to assist is very limited until it's reopened.
Correct.
So in this instance, the RO denied the reopening of this claim.
Right. And the reason that I didn't cite it was because the board didn't rely on that. To me, the essence of 20.903 is a comparison between the law relied upon by the VA versus the law that was relied upon by the board in its self-evident decision that they were considering law that was going to result in a denial, which it obviously did result in a denial.
With regard to the statutes and regulations, as I understand your clarified position, the regional office did consider them, and you're bifurcating them into a consideration for new and material versus a consideration for award.
Yes, Your Honor. Even the Federal Circuit in its recent Sims decision recognized, as this court did in Bernard, that two distinct questions were being addressed. And that's what really makes this difference. We have a far different fact set if we merely had a case involving service connection and we didn't have the additional element of reopening. At that particular juncture, it would be, I think, just a bare-bones comparison between what was in the SOC or subsequent SSOCs and what was in the board decision. And whether that comparison results in a conclusion that the board relied upon law that was not relied upon below. Here, you're right, we have
to make...
Is there
any requirement for the regional office to cite every single regulation or statute that was considered?
No.
So there's a presumption of regularity that the regional office considered all the applicable regulations and statutes, is there not?
Certainly. But in considering all of those, they never dealt with the merits. In the limitation
of
that...
But going to the example you were just using, if it was a service connection only...
Then that presumption would apply.
You have to stand before us and tell us just because it was not in the regional office's decision or statement of the case that it was not considered, would you not?
Well, frankly, I think that would depend on how the board relied on the law that was presumably considered by the VA. For instance, if the board considered a new decision from this court or a new decision from the Federal Circuit that altered the law in relationship to a particular point, let's say consideration of lay evidence under Buchanan or Jandreau, which would be applicable in this particular case. If that were presumably considered by the VA, but an intervening decision from this court or the Federal Circuit happened and the board wanted to consider that adversely, then notice would be required under 20.903B. And that didn't happen here, and that was error, and Mr. Hickson was prejudiced by that error because he didn't get the opportunity to submit additional evidence and argument as is contemplated by the regulation.
So, Mr. Carpenter, on your supplemental brief, or memorandum of law, pages 5 and 6, where you detail the law that was relied on by the board, and your position is that the board should have provided notice.
Yes.
At that time, I have a list of about 26 items or so, including statutes, regulations, and cases.
But there were four statutes that identified four regulations and 26 cases that were cited by the board. But as I explained to Judge Castle, I really have to modify that position because that comparison was made simply to the original SOC in 1999. I concede that I overlooked the 2004 and 2006 supplemental statements of the case. The government cited to one of the two of those supplemental statements of the case, and clearly you have to factor those in, and so that would be reduced.
Okay, let me direct your attention to...
I think I've expired, Your Honor.
Let me direct your attention to the record on page 923.
Yes.
And there, beginning at that page, and actually going through to about 1008 or so, there's a series of communications, letters from you to Chief Counsel's Litigation Support Division, basically dealing with, as far as I can tell, a number of items, new and material evidence, reopen. All these communications are not labeled that way, but dealing with the new and material evidence reopen issue. If you look at these, and the secretary suggests that this is an indication, these documents are indications of you arguing the merits, what is your response?
Well, that they are partially correct in that clearly the intention of reopening is to ultimately prevail on the merits. But if you will examine the submission that was made immediately before the board decision in this case, which is at the record at 995 to, I believe it's 4,000, or 1,003, you will note that what was requested was a finding that new and material evidence had been submitted and a reopening of the case and a request for an examination. There was not a request for a merit determination. Now, in fairness, no advocate is going to be asking the board not to make a favorable determination. But the government's position simply misunderstands the VA's regulation. The government would suggest that because service connection is implicitly at issue in a claim to reopen, that the board gets a free pass under 20.903B. The board does not get a free pass under 20.903B if, as it did here, it relied upon law to the detriment of the appellant that was not relied upon. And I would point the court to four specific cases, the three cases on credibility and the one case on probative value. Credibility is presumed at the reopening stage and is not an issue. Credibility, once the case is reopened, is at issue. Credibility was not discussed by the board relative to the issue of reopening because credibility was presumed. The board then relied upon those three cases to the detriment of Mr. Hickson. As a consequence, and that resulted in a denial, as a consequence, the provisions of 20.903B were implicated, notice was required, an opportunity to submit evidence and argument was required. The board didn't give the notice. Mr. Hickson was deprived of those benefits, which was prejudicial. That was error, and reversal is required.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Gail Stroman, and I represent the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs in this matter. The Secretary contends that the February 2000 board decision should be affirmed, and in addressing the 20.903B issue, we would assert that the Secretary's interpretation of this regulation is vastly different than that presented by appellant. The Secretary believes that this regulation intended this regulation when it was promulgated to affect situations where there was a change in the law after the agency of original jurisdiction had issued its decision, and that change warranted the board to notify the appellant and give him or her an opportunity to respond. The regulation's promulgation...
So if there's the general standing law on reopening and what you do after reopening, if that law has not changed during the adjudication of the reopened claim, there's no requirement under 20.309 to provide that notice?
Correct, Your Honor. We feel that the protections in the situation you're describing and the presentation of the situation here have already been adjudicated and set out in not only Bernard, but reaffirmed in Sims, where the board has to go through a prejudice analysis with regard to due process in the decision before they proceed to the merits. And in fact, the board did that here. For four pages, they laid out why they felt it was okay for them, under the process protections that are entitled to a veteran in these situations, to proceed to the merits. And
so
the appellant has never objected to that.
Assuming the regulation should be interpreted the way you're suggesting now, you still have the Bernard analysis to be conducted.
The board
did the Bernard analysis. Mm-hmm. Why should we accept that?
The Bernard analysis, Your
Honor? Why was this not prejudicial? At what point did the regional office make a determination on weighing the facts as to whether or not the duty to desist required some additional action? At what point did the regional office make a determination on the merits?
Well, Your Honor, the regional office did not make a determination on the merits here, clearly. But under the Bernard analysis, that's not required. Under the Bernard analysis, what's required is, was the appellant provided with appropriate notice and the opportunity to have a hearing or be heard on that, and was the duty to assist satisfied? And in this case, the board did discuss all of those factors and determined that it was. You talked about a limited duty to assist in new material evidence situations. That limited duty to assist is really limited to, for want of a better description, the provision of an examination. The agency is not required to provide an examination until the claim is reopened. Other than that, the duty to assist provisions in 5103 and 3.159 do, in fact, apply in a notice, in a new material evidence context, and the agency does have to get evidence identified by appellant and other forms of duty to assist. In this case, the board went through the analysis of saying that this just wasn't enough evidence to get an exam, and while the RO...
I thought the RO did give an exam.
They did at one point, Your Honor, in the process.
The
exam did not...
They didn't have to.
Because the agency at times does more than they need to under the regulations and the law, Your Honor. And in this case, with regard to the Bernard analysis, the Secretary would first assert that the appellant has not challenged that analysis itself ever in any of his pleadings before this court. In addition, the Secretary would assert that their analysis is supported by the record. In fact, he was given an examination by the RO, which wasn't warranted.
Is there any additional evidence submitted after that examination?
By the appellant, Your Honor. I believe he submitted some statements by his family that were regarding the onset of his symptomatology. And some statements of his own.
What was this claim for denied originally?
It was denied originally, Your Honor, by the board because there was nothing in service and there was no nexus. And this claim was denied.
It looked to me like the board was trying to say that this claim was originally denied for all three reasons, because there was nothing in service, because he had no current disability, and there was no nexus.
Well, if you take a broad interpretation, originally it was sort of denied across the board. I think the focus of the
if
first...
If you have no current disability, there can be no benefits, can there?
No.
Well, initially the disability, if you will, was a personality disorder.
Correct.
And so that, therefore, was determined not to be compensable under the...
Correct, Your Honor.
So without that, and then without any disease in service, there would not be any need to have a medical nexus?
It's true, Your Honor. I guess that the Secretary was sort of here is that we are getting into the merits of the case, which we do sort of have to do, but in terms of the applicability of 20.903B at issue here, the Secretary asserts it just doesn't apply in this situation.
What part of the regulation are you reading that makes it not apply, that makes it only apply to, for example, a new regulation that was passed or a case that came about?
Well, on space, the Secretary would assert that it says it's law that the board intends to consider that was not considered by the agency of original jurisdiction that could result in a denial, so it is not intended to be prejudicatory, and I would point to also the Federal Register for that, where the agency made clear in the Federal Register when they promulgated the final rule that it was not intended to be prejudicatory. At 67 Federal Register 3100, they also made clear in that regulation, rulemaking, that the intention of this amendments to this regulation and to all the regulations at issue were to reduce the number of remands back to the regional office. And they specifically cited to the fact that in the year prior to the promulgation of the regulation, 27% of the board's remands were because the agency of original jurisdiction had to consider law that wasn't in effect at the time of the original decision, and that they were putting 20.903C in there to provide notice and an opportunity to be heard in those situations where no remand would now be promulgated. So, again, the Secretary asserts that we made it clear what the intention of this regulation was in the Federal Register at the time we promulgated the final rule.
You gave an example, but that example didn't seem to me to be all-encompassing. What part of the Federal Register or this regulation itself would indicate to anyone looking at it that it was all-encompassing and would only apply... or limited, I guess, would only apply in situations where a regulation was promulgated subsequent to the RO decision, a statute came about subsequent, or a case was issued subsequent?
Well, my answer would be twofold, Your Honor. On its face, the Secretary asserts that the regulation does make it clear that that's
where
the natural
that?
Language. In the regulation as a whole.
Well, I'm looking at it. Does that take me to
where right.
it does?
And I'm reading it as a whole. It says, if the board considers law not already considered by the agency of original jurisdiction and pursuant to 19.9B, board intends to consider law not already considered by the agency of original jurisdiction, and such consideration could result in a denial of the appeal, the board will notify the appellant and his or her representative, if any, of its intent to do so, which is consider the law. And such consideration, in the first instance, by the board, could result in a denial of this appeal. But then the provision goes on and says that if you skip the 60-day notice mm-hmm. period at the end, that there are exceptions. Exceptions being where the appellant argues the law before the board or if the board intends to grant. And again, the Secretary would assert that given that the agency of original jurisdiction is presumed to have applied all the law and considered it unless shown otherwise, that the only interpretation on the face that you can make here is that this is law that the agency of original jurisdiction was presumed not to have considered, which is law that wasn't in effect and was not applicable. Therefore, it has to be new change in law. Now, if you don't accept the on-the-face interpretation, Your Honor, the Secretary would assert that we have interpreted this regulation and our interpretation is controlling and entitled to deference.
But I'm having trouble understanding how you could conclude that if the RO denied reopening, then the RO necessarily never got to questions of law that it would be germane to the adjudication itself.
Well, Your Honor, in answer to that question, I would bring us back, in essence, to Bernard, where this court, and then again Sims and some other cases addressing this, where they said that the question here is that the veteran isn't seeking reopening. The veteran is seeking compensation, which is on the merits. He wants service connection. And in the course of determining whether or not you're entitled to reopening, you, by definition, even this court has even affirmed this to a certain extent, by requiring the means of the last denial to be provided to an appellant in the notice process, you have to consider, do you have evidence of all the requirements for service connection?
But Mr. Hickson presented an issue of presumptive service connection.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which the RO never considered.
Well, to the contrary, the Secretary would assert that in the November 2004 supplemental statement of the case, the regional office did in fact cite to the regulations governing presumptive service connection. And that, in fact, in the course of reopening, if there was evidence that warranted substantiation of service connection on a presumptive basis, that would have warranted reopening by the regional office in their consideration of his claim to reopen.
So you're saying that the presumptive argument was presented as a means to reopen the case?
Correct, Your Honor, but also in the consideration of reopening, because of the nature of these claims to reopen, you have to consider, to a certain extent, the merits of service connection in determining if something's going to be reopened. The lens through which you consider that may vary, but it's actually more favorable in the context of reopening. But still, you need to look at the elements of service connection to determine, has he now provided new evidence that's material to service connection in order for us to reopen and go about this now with that extra duty to provide an exam if necessary.
Assume for a second he did not get another medical exam at the regional office level. And the regional office determined that there was not new material evidence. Mm-hmm. And the board determined that there was. Under those circumstances, you would have a situation where the regional office never got to a review or consideration of the duty to assist with regard to a medical exam. Could the board proceed at that time?
I believe the board could if they felt like the evidence didn't warrant a medical exam and they went through the analysis required.
How would that comport with the two reviews that Congress said a veteran's entitled to?
Well, again, in Bernard, this court, and in Sims, the Federal Circuit has recognized that this is a single matter on appeal. It isn't two appeals.
Well, it's not a jurisdictional issue. Even Bernard says if you can't address an issue without first determining whether or not it's prejudicial. How can it not be prejudicial to a veteran to have, for the first time, a review at the board as opposed to a first time at the RO level, who might give it to them, or a second time at the board?
Well, Your Honor, I would say it depends on the facts of the case. If there's no evidence...
No, I just gave you the facts.
Well,
the facts,
the facts of even the case that you gave me is that...
Well, new material.
Correct, Your Honor.
Denied, therefore, no consideration of a medical exam.
If, in that situation, however, there was no new evidence, or the new evidence consisted of a duplicate of the statement that the appellant had previously submitted prior to a previous denial, for whatever reason the board determined that that was enough to reopen, the Secretary would assert that still the board would be able to do an analysis under Bernard to determine if the only thing at issue here now is this statement that doesn't change the playing field back from when we originally denied it on the merits and determined that no additional development was warranted, that we would not be prejudicing the appellant in that case as to whether we proceeded to adjudicate at the board level.
Well, I accepted your argument, or I understood your position, that if the board went through an analysis as to whether or not it rose to the level of being new material, then in a sense they considered service connection. That kind of can flow. You can understand it. I'm having a hard time understanding and following how that translates into a determination that a medical exam was not needed. Once that regional office determines that new material evidence has not been submitted, they don't get to the second level. They never consider the medical exam. I know they gave one here. We can talk about that in a minute. They never consider it. Now, the board determines that that evidence does rise to the level of new material, and in the first instance makes a determination that veteran did not have a second review on that major issue.
again, Your Honor, it's circular to say that in most instances that would probably require that the board send it back, but if the board, I can't stand here and say that there's not a situation such as the one I laid out where the board would be in error in finding no prejudice.
So back to this case, they did give a medical exam.
They did.
And the only thing submitted after that were the
I believe were the list statements, right. And the board
did
announce.
Which were sent back to the RO, and the RO determined that they were not sufficient to give new material. The board then said it was new material, but then denied the claim.
Correct. Again, the secretary would assert that 20.903B does not have application here, as it applies, and the secretary intended it to apply in situations where there was an actual change in the law after the agency original jurisdiction's final decision. That wasn't the situation here, and that the board here did an adequate analysis as to prejudice to the veteran in considering it on the merits pursuant to the
government. Don't go in yet, because I'd like to go back to your, I'm not completely following why you say 20.903 on its face. Doesn't apply, but then you followed that up with an argument that it's been your practice. Well, how do I know it's been your practice? No offense, but
standing here for you, I can tell you that it is our practice, and council has conversed with people at the board, and the practice of the board in applying this regulation has generally been when there was a change in law, particularly a change in a diagnostic code since the final denial by the agency of original jurisdiction.
There's no M21-1 or anything that would indicate that.
No, Your Honor, because this isn't a regulation at the board, so the M21 applies to adjudicators at the agency of original jurisdiction, so there wouldn't be an M21 provision on this one.
No, but the adjudicators is the practice I think you're telling me about, isn't it?
No, I'm talking about the board, because this regulation governs the board, so it would be the board's practices with regard to applying this regulation that are at issue.
But we have, I mean, I know you've told us this, but there's no other empirical evidence to look at to say that.
I have an unsworn statement from an employee at the board who's in high position, Your Honor.
Got it.
If there's no further questions from the court, the secretary would assert that the February 2007 decision should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Why doesn't the fact that your client got a medical exam satisfy all of the regulations and statutes? The dual consideration by the RO first and then the board. In other words, in this case, your client got a medical exam.
And that medical exam, if you'll review it in the record, Your Honor, expressly refers to the fact that there isn't any evidence about the symptoms during service. And that's precisely what the affidavits from the mother and the sister provided, to include the symptoms and manifestations immediately following service. So you have both symptoms and manifestations in service and symptoms and manifestations within the presumptive period, neither of which were considered by the examiner, and the examiner expressly noted the relevant portion is at 967, but it may be the preceding page and the following page from 967. But the part that I'm referring to says, I initially note that the BVA did not, or no, sorry, I'm sorry, that's the wrong citation. It's 887. I'll get it in just a minute. The examiner indicates in his report that the rating board has requested an opinion as to whether Mr. Hickson's current psychiatric symptoms began while in service. It is clear that Mr. Hickson believes that they did, though the absence of any report of psychotic symptoms in either the military records or in the psychiatric examinations that occurred within the following 10-year period, there is no basis on which to conclude that his current psychotic symptomatology reflect a disorder that was present at that time.
Now, he didn't submit evidence in either the military records or the psychiatric examination, so I guess your position is that it would be the credibility of him and his statements, and that the RO should have made that credibility determination in the first instance?
No, actually, it's the receipt after this 2004 examination of the affidavits from the mother and the sister, which described that, which should have resulted in another examination to determine whether that would be sufficient evidence to establish the presence of that symptomatology.
Before you even get to another examination, wouldn't the board or the RO, I'm assuming your position is the RO, should have made a determination before the board made a determination in the first instance as to the credibility of those statements. Because if the regional office made a determination that the credibility did not attach to those statements, there would be no reason to get another medical examiner.
Well, as I understand the law under Evans in this court, Your Honor, that Evans requires the VA to presume that evidence that is being submitted is credible.
Only with regard to the actual new material opening, is it not?
That's correct. Well, but that's when this was submitted. This was submitted in 2006.
We've gone to the board. The board reopened. At the board reopening, I gather your position is to send it back to the regional office.
Oh, yes.
The regional office then makes a determination with regard to credibility. And if they find it credible, they may want to get another medical exam where they might be able to explain a reason why not, et cetera.
That would be correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I thought we were talking about the credibility determination at the RO level between 2004 and 2006. I'm sorry, I got misdirected. Okay. I would also like to comment on the...
Excuse me. When did the board find those statements not credible?
I'm not sure that the board found those statements not credible. They do make a credibility determination about the veterans' statements. Frankly, I found the board's discussion of credibility a little tenuous, but they seemed to say if he wasn't credible, then his mother and his sister would not be credible. But I don't believe they, in fact, made a credibility determination on those lay statements. But what they did do was they cited to three cases that talked about credibility determination, which is the new law that was relied upon by the board that had not been relied upon by the VA, because the VA was required to have presumed that the evidence submitted in support of reopening was credible. So therefore, clearly, new law was considered. I would like to return to the government's post hoc rationalization that the reason for this regulation now covers change in law. Number one, they didn't say that in their supplemental brief. They said the reason was that it dealt with prejudice. Now, in fact, in the public notice by the VA in August of 2001, what the VA said was, we want to ensure that an appellant will receive adequate notice of new evidence obtained by the board. And of course, at that time, they had the evidentiary portion in there, and which was nullified under DAVV Principi. And the board intends to consider, but has not already considered by the agency of original jurisdiction. And we also want to respond to the additional evidence of law. To that end, the purpose of this amendment is to require the board, if it either obtains pertinent evidence on its own or intends to consider law that has not already been considered by the AOJ, to notify the appellant and the appellant's representative of the evidence or law and allow a 60-day period. There's no discussion of prejudice. Prejudice is not part of the equation under 20.903. There are two things that are important to understand about the difference between Bernard and 20.903. Bernard involves evidence. 20.903 involves law. Bernard involves the question of prejudice. 20.903 does not. If you find error, then you make the prejudicial error analysis. Prejudice, as contemplated under Bernard, is not part of the equation under 20.903. They took it out. The board simply has to make a determination of its intent. Whether you call that pre-adjudicatory or not, I'm not sure how you do that, but you have to establish your intent. You know, it's the intention of the golfer when he or she takes the stance. It's the intention of the board to rely upon new law that was not considered by the VA that could result in denial, which is precisely what happened here.
Well, it's not even rely, it's just considered. I mean, the regulation is just considered.
Yes, but was relied on by the VA that was then ultimately considered by the board. I'm sorry if I misspoke and put relied in the wrong place there.
If the board considers law not already considered by the agency of original jurisdiction.
Does this mean that every time the RO denies reopening and there's an appeal to the board, and the board on that same record grants reopening.
Yes.
20.903 would require the board to provide notice to the claimant once the board starts re-adjudicating.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And
unless the board's going to grant.
Unless the board's going to grant.
And generally, if the board rules that their case should be reopened and begins the adjudication, doesn't the claimant participate in that?
In the reopening? Yes, sir.
Or in the re-adjudication?
In the re-adjudication of the reopened claim, which, of course, did not happen here. He was not informed that his claim had been reopened, and the adjudication of that reopened...
He was not informed that the board had reopened.
That's correct. And then they went on to do their adjudication. And I believe that is the stop sign which has been erected by 20.903B.
Now, your letter to the board, or your letter to the RO saying you waive, I guess, whatever at the RO and wish to go to the board for de novo review and consideration of additional evidence mm-hmm. and the presumption of service connection played no role then in that subsequent?
No, because that's a question of evidence, i.e. Bernard, and not a question of law under 20.903.
So as to the evidence the board considered, that was okay with you. There's no error on the board's part.
No, as a matter of fact, the board evidence. Arrived in half of the loaf at the correct decision. They overturned the VA's decision that new and material evidence had not been submitted.
But then they went on to adjudicate the claim.
That's correct.
It was okay for them to consider any additional evidence that the RO had not considered.
It would only be possible to consider that evidence if they met the Bernard threshold.
Okay.
But they could not consider law.
You had a waiver in there, right? Didn't you request didn't you submit? That you waived
consideration of any other evidence.
Okay.
But that was not. There are two different kinds of waivers there. The first waiver is to proceed without submitting additional evidence. The second waiver is I've given you new evidence and I waive the right for consideration by the VA in the first instance. That happened in this case, which resulted in a remand. It is now required under DAVV Principi. Because if there's no waiver, then it has to go back so that there are two decisions, not one decision.
Very good.
Let me follow up on that point from the Chief. Mr. Carpenter, you indicated that had you had the opportunity to submit additional evidence that the board denied you by their decision, you would have submitted a private medical examination.
Establishing nexus based upon the affidavits of the veteran's mother, and the veteran's sister about symptoms and manifestations in service and symptoms within the presumptive period and relative to continuity of symptomatology. There are really three different ways for Mr. Hickson to establish by way of his lay evidence, which is part of what's addressed by the Federal Circuit's decision in the use of lay evidence in Buchanan and Jandreau to establish service connection.
Is there other evidence you would have submitted as well?
Not that occurs to me at the time, no. Or at this time, I suppose I should say. I believe I've expired. Thank you all
very
much.
The case is submitted. We will greet counsel and
all
then
right.
Adjourn.
This is your whole yard.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the warning.
Court will now be in recess. Those of you who can remain.